Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For the past 3.5 years, Nathan Larson has been traveling full-time throughout North America, photographing and writing from some of the continent's most remote landscapes, the Arctic Ocean, the edge of Labrador, Key West, Alaska, Newfoundland. He says photography has been his primary creative practice for decades, but his new book, Field Notes on Avoidance, is the first project where the photographs and poems were created together as a single body of work. Nathan Larson grew up across the United States, from the Rocky Mountains to the Green Mountains. He discovered photography at a young age, began writing poetry and essays while studying at the University of Chicago. He's published previously 2 monographs, Avian and Cloud Hunter, as well as 2 books in the Why We Stay series. His photographs have appeared in magazines, book covers, and galleries and collections around the world. Nathan Larson continues his travels, and he's stopped here in Logan in studio with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
So you, what do you have, an RV or something?
I have a Sprinter van that's been heavily modified that allows me to stay, I guess, what we call off-grid, so solar panels and lithium batteries. So I can get kind of in the outback and in places that are out of the way and stay for days.
So why this latest trip? 3.5 years traveling North America.
Yeah, I think it was inspired by, I've always had a very curious and inquisitive mind and always wanted to explore, and I think I started to feel a bit of getting older and still so many places to see, so many experiences to have, and decided the best way to do that was to hit the road. So it's been a trip all across and up and down and sideways across North America for the last few years.
Yeah. We'll get to talk about the book, result of this, photographs and poems. So let's get a bit of your background, very interesting background. Grew up in the West and the East, all over.
Yes. Yeah, my dad moved around a lot when we were growing up. So we lived all over the Rocky Mountain states and in the Southwest. And then when I was about 6th grade, we moved to the East Coast, lived in Connecticut and Vermont. And then I've bounced around since then and lived in different places. So, yeah, I think the West definitely feels like home to me. And I think it was because I lived here in such, you know, impressionable ages in Wyoming and Utah and other places. But I've had the opportunity to live all over the U.S.
Including in Logan.
Yes. I lived in Logan when I was, I think, from probably 3rd grade through 6th grade. Lived up in the Cliffside neighborhood when Cliffside, we were the last house in Cliffside. So there was nothing but. You would walk out the sliding doors of my back house. There's a little patch of lawn and then just mountains.
Yeah.
And so when we would go play, my mom really meant go play anywhere. So we would go running into the mountains. And it was one of my favorite places we ever lived. I just drove back up there last night when I got into town, and I can't believe how much it's grown.
Yeah. And you, as you were leaving Logan...
Yes.
Sixth grade.
I got a little sentimental about leaving Logan. I think, you know, it was the age and a lot had happened here. I was thinking last night about all the wonderful teachers I had and experiences I had. So when I found out we were moving right in the middle of a school year. I decided to bury a time capsule.
Yeah.
So I gathered these things that I thought were really critical to me at that time. One was a USU Aggies football banner pennant. So my best friend at the time, his dad was an assistant coach on the USU Aggies. So I loved that team and used to go to the games. So I put the pennant in there. I put a picture of a girl I had a crush on in middle school. A whole bunch of other things. And I wrapped one of my mom's chocolate chip cookies in tinfoil. And I put that in the time capsule as well. And the story is I went and buried it, and then we were moving later that week. And a couple days later, I really wanted a cookie. So I looked all over the house. My mom hadn't baked any. I have 4 brothers and sisters, so usually the cookies were gone immediately when my mom made anything. And so I thought, well, I know where there's one cookie. So I hiked all the way back up the mountain, and I unburied the time capsule, and I unwrapped the cookie and ate it, and then I reburied the time capsule, and then we moved away.
Yeah. But,
so the time capsule's without cookie.
Yeah.
I took care of that.
Yeah, you took care of that, yeah. Probably better. Who knows what shape that
cookie. That's true.
So did you make the time capsule? What was it?
Yeah, it was a very, it was a mason jar that was wrapped in a whole bunch of stuff that I had found, and like tin foil and like a box. So it was probably crushed at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little, in my little kid mind, it was going to be there forever, you know?
You think it's still there?
It looks like there's houses there now. Okay. I couldn't quite make out last night. I'll probably go back this afternoon when we're done. But it looks like they've built a whole neighborhood in those foothills now.
Yeah. So you moved around a lot. Your dad was in mining?
My dad was in mining, and so a lot of coal and copper in my childhood. But when we lived here, he worked for Pepperidge Farm, and they owned Godiva Chocolate at the time. So one of the wonderful things about that period of my life was instead of bringing home copper and coal, he brought home Mint Milanos that were too heavy to be shipped, or Godiva Chocolates that had broken. So those were sweet times. Those were good.
Literally.
And then he went back to mining. So
Ended up in, you said, talc mining.
Yeah. Out east, there are talc mines. And so that's, you know, we ended up out east, and in Vermont, there are large talc mines. And he went back into the mining industry. And that's what took us out east. Yeah.
I was fascinated by the effect of nature. It's could be anywhere, right?
Yeah.
I'm biased toward the West. I'm born and raised in the West. But maybe contrast that as a boy, right?
Immediately, it felt claustrophobic initially because I was so used to the big, wide open spaces, endless skies, you know, living in Wyoming in the prairies and then living here in Logan where, as I mentioned, the mountains were my backyard. When we initially moved to Connecticut, I felt claustrophobic. I've come to love it. It is so lush and so green and just such a unique part of our country. But as a kid, it was a big transition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, and also here, all the roads are laid out on grids. Well, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So there is no grids for the roads. So I also remember just navigating the East, which sounds silly to say it out loud now. I got lost a lot because all the roads just turn and twist and go wherever they want around the hills there. And out here, you know, everything, of course, is north and south and east and west. So I remember that as a kid as well, thinking like, how does anybody find their way around this place? Yeah.
I get kind of lost when I'm back east. You're in trees, and you're kind of, and you don't have the mountains to navigate.
Yeah, with. Exactly. You don't have those landmarks. There's kind of two specific, when you're there and it's all leafed in, you also don't really see the houses. So it's a little bit deceiving when all the leaves fall after the fall, and the fall is incredible. You actually see where everybody lives.
Right.
I have neighbors there. I didn't know that.
Yeah. You ended up at one point in Vermont?
In Vermont. That's where I finished high school, in Woodstock, Vermont, and then went on to college after that. And Vermont is an incredibly important part of my life. It's really where my younger siblings grew up most of their lives, and a lot of connections and friends there. Really became home, for sure. Yeah.
Are there mines up there?
Talc mines. Talc mines up there. Not far from where where I live, yeah.
Yeah. So you've done just about everything and got the t-shirt, right? So let's just talk about it. You've worked as a roofer.
Yes.
Drug hazardous waste pits, dug hazardous waste pits. Tell me about those two.
Yeah, so I was looking for work, you know, around college and going into college and picked up a gig in Tooele working for a construction company and was assigned to a roofing crew immediately. And it was a traveling roofing crew, so we traveled all over the West roofing. And a funny story about that is when I showed up the first day, I was kind of being hazed a bit. I was a young kid. Nobody knew me. I'd moved to town, gotten this job, and this was a really kind of seasoned, salty crew. And they asked where I was living in Tooele. And I told them I'm living at Beverly White's house. And then they all just walked away. Hmm. And I thought, well, that's weird because my aunt is Beverly White. Hmm. And then I went home that night and I said to Bev, like, hey, Aunt Bev, I told them I was living here, and they all just ignored me for the rest of the day. And she goes, tell me their names. So I gave her the names, and she was in the Utah State Legislature for years, but she was also a parole officer. And many of those names were her clients, I'll say. So once they found out I was living at her house, I was they just cut a wide circle around me.
Interesting.
But we traveled over the West roofing, Elko, Nevada, all over Utah, Wyoming,
Yeah, it's going to be a tough job, especially in the
It was not fun. Yeah. I would not recommend.
Yeah. You founded a theater company.
Yeah, after college, so I graduated from the University of Chicago. Theater was a huge part of my life at that point, both in high school and college. And so after college, I started a nonprofit theater company and a children's theater company in Vermont. So we would do theater education in elementary schools, and then we would put on shows in the summer outside. And so I did that for about 3 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, another connection to Utah, you worked for an organization – that is included as organizer Terry Tempest Williams
yes.
And other prominent
yes.
folks.
Yeah, huge part, really critical moment of development for me was being a part of Round River Conservation. And like you said, it's formed and originated by Doug Sizemore and a whole troop of just incredible conservationists and authors and writers. And I was on the Mexican Wolf Reintroduction Project. So I was down in the Blue Range Primitive Area for 3 or 4 months working as a student researcher. I was there specifically looking at the impact on the White Mountain Apache and the ranchers and other folks from a cultural standpoint. And then helping with the biological research as well. But being around those people, Doug Sizemore, Terry Tempest Williams, Doug Peacock, Rick Bass, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Incredibly influential just to watch those folks move through the world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was it about them? Were you familiar with their writings?
I was familiar with their writings before I met some of them, and I certainly read all their stuff while I was, you know, on the project and have read everything they've written since then. And I think it was more watching people. I had read Aldo Leopold and Edward Albee and other writers, you know, Wallace Stegner, and seen people write about the West and talk about the impact of humans on the West, but to watch people do it in my time, real time, and in a contemporary time was really incredibly impactful for me. Mm-hmm. You know, to kind of take the moment to stop and observe and look at how we're impacting nature and how nature's impacting us, and see that come out in creative writing and editorial writing was really, really impactful.
Yeah. So I got to single out Doug Peacock. You got to meet Doug Peacock.
Got to meet Doug Peacock. Well, the first time I met him, I dropped into Round River Conservation Project a little bit late. And so we were rallying at a bowling alley in Morenci, Arizona, to then go to the campsite. And that's where I met Doug Peacock for the first time, is at a bowling alley in Morenci. Immediate impression on me. Like, he is a force of nature. I knew about him. I had watched some of his old films about grizzly bears. I'd read his initial book about grizzly bears. And yeah, I met him at a bowling alley in Morenci, and then later that night watched him walk into the woods and kind of talk about how he doesn't hang around with people at night. And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, his book, I recommend his books to everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Walking It Off is an incredible book.
Right. Yeah, he famously was in the Vietnam War, you know,
yes.
PTSD, and yeah. It was nature and grizzly bears that helped heal
yes.
him, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you owned and operated an outdoor adventure school and retail
yeah,
shops.
For a number of years, I kind of took some of my outdoor passion and I ran a fly fishing schools, off-road driving schools, sporting clay schools, mostly for luxury resorts or high-end resorts. So we would be that company that would set up those amenities at resorts for people to go and explore those things in a safe way. And that really became a way for me to stay connected to the outdoors as well.
Yeah. You say you co-founded a gastropub and a restored yeah. railway station.
Yeah, in Vermont, a couple of hospitality projects in Vermont with my siblings, actually, were we built a small luxury inn in the former home of the editor of Ernest Hemingway, Maxwell Perkins, and then also the old rail station in town we converted into a gastropub and ran that as well, yeah.
Yeah. What are those experiences?
Well, I had been in the hospitality industry on and off with those outdoor schools, and I think, you know, it was the history of those places, seeing the history and being able to preserve the history of those buildings and enhance those buildings and tell the stories of those buildings, and then try to come up with businesses, you know, that would help keep those buildings alive was kind of a big part of it. And yeah, in Vermont has an incredible history behind it, you know, especially a literary history. There's a whole artistic movement in that area called the Cornish Colony with famous authors and poets and writers. And so it's a really interesting place to kind of try to bring those stories to life or keep them alive.
Now, at a certain point, probably when you were a boy, you picked up a camera.
Yeah, when I was 12 years old, I got my first camera for my birthday, 35mm camera. I still have it, still use it, actually. And I was obsessed, like, from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I remember the first day having that camera in a little book that Kodak used to make basically how to take a picture.
Yeah.
And was out in my backyard taking pictures of flowers and clouds and trees. And I had a wonderful teacher at the time who ran the photography program in the sixth grade classroom. And so she brought me into the dark room, taught me how to use the dark room. So right from the get-go, I was into the dark room process as well, which to me always gave me an editor's eye for photography. So I was taking the photos, but I was also thinking about all the ways I could manipulate the photos later, because I was learning all these cool, double exposure, long exposure, different types of papers, different ways of developing. And so I think that really changed how I looked at photography right from the beginning, because I was in the dark room right from the beginning. It's been since I was 12, really, that's been a passion. Yeah.
So as technology has changed, digital cameras now is made things easier, maybe, I would think, to manipulate things, but is anything lost in that?
You can take a process? Lot more photos.
Okay.
So the consequences aren't as high for how many photos you take, or the cost, I should say. You know, one challenge I give myself now, though, is I used to buy rolls of, 36 exposure film. And so some days I'll go out and I'll say, you have 36 photos today.
Yeah.
And so it does slow you down and say, is that the photo I want to take if I only have 36 photos to take today?
Yeah.
So I try to kind of keep that spirit of film photography in what I do, to be selective about it, because it is pretty easy with either your phone or digital camera just to hold the shutter down. It's I think they're all tools. I love digital. I love film. I do wet plate photography on and off. I think they're all just great tools depending on what story you're trying to tell.
So doing photography, at least the way you do it, and, a lot of people just pull out their phone, right, and could take some pretty good photographs. Does that make you more present, do you think? Because in some cases, for some people, it takes them away from the experience.
I think it's actually because of phones becoming as wonderful as they are for photography, maybe you're less present. And the reason I say that is I go to a lot of national parks now, and I actually see people show up at the national park, snap a selfie, and leave.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably there, honestly, 5 minutes sometimes. You can go to really famous landmark points in national parks and see people driving, get out, take a photo, get in their car, and drive away. And I do think about, maybe the phone is – they're there to get the picture, but they're not really present when they're taking the picture. And that's a very different way to use a camera and to move through the world than, maybe to contemplate your 36 photos for the day.
Right.
So I guess it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. It depends on your intent, I guess, with anything.
Do you – as a photographer, do you think you see the world differently?
I do. I mean, photography, any kind of visual art medium, you think about painters that have a very particular point of view. And there's a painter that I love who lives here in Utah, Doug Fryer. And he paints his paintings almost like you're watching images move by when you're driving by a car window. They're kind of blurry is the wrong word, but it's like that view you have as a kid of seeing the horses in the field as you drive by, but kind of in motion. Those are really particular points of view that you can get with photography exist as well. So I do think it slows you down. You can be very inventive with it. You can be very, you can bring your style out in photography. It does. I think it does change how you see the world.
I want to quote you here. You say, I believe slowing down and paying attention is a creative and perhaps even cultural act.
Yes, I think it takes focus and intention to slow down and observe. I mean, I've said this before, that one of the things I try to do to get into that meditative state is to sit and watch a cloud pass by fully. And if you've ever tried to do that, it's really hard.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Watch a cloud form and disappear, watch a cloud cross the horizon. And, I've talked to people about that before. But those types of practices of really slowing down, because what happens is you actually start to hear things as well. You start to notice sounds. You start to notice light differently. But I believe that's truly something that has to be practiced and developed. Our lives and technology and all the things, make it hard or kind of counter to acting that way.
I was just gonna say that. It seems like a lot of things in our lives, everyday lives, pull against that.
And I think that's why I'm doing this trip, honestly. It's removing a lot of distraction, right? So if it's just me out there alone with some solitude, and I think solitude is a necessary part of it sometimes, not all the time, but I think that this is part of that practice. This is mm-hmm. part of finding that time to sit and observe and not have the distractions of everything else.
What does paying attention do for you? And I guess the opposite on the other side is what is lack of paying attention? Rust lives, what does that do against us?
I think you see the interconnectedness of things more when you stop and pay attention. It becomes almost obvious, the interconnectedness of things, both in nature but also us to nature. And I think the opposite of that is when we rush through that, we just don't stop and think about it. You know, you don't think about the consequences of our actions as much in nature, and we certainly don't think about maybe our place or the inevitability of some of the things that are happening with nature. So yeah, I think it's that interconnectedness that becomes very clear when you stop and observe. And also just the intricacy, the details, you know, how light and soil and air and animals interact with each other becomes really obvious at a micro level when you stop and mm-hmm. listen and watch.
And it occurs to me as we were talking about this, it's an act of taking attention back, right? Today's so many companies commodify attention.
Yeah.
They try to suck our attention in and keep it, right?
Right.
The almighty algorithm.
So yeah.
This is an act of defiance, I guess.
It really is. And, you know, it's a hard to do what I do. I need an audience to I think, share. You don't need an audience, but it's nice to have an audience to share in seeing what you're producing. And to do that, you have to be, you know, in some ways out creating an audience somewhere. And social media is one place to do that. So I have kind of a love-hate relationship with it in a lot of ways. Like, it's a great place to find people you would never find otherwise. And I've made incredible connections because of social media. But at the same time, yeah, it's counter to what I'm trying to do. So yeah, it's a real tension.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Let's take a break. We are talking with Nathan Larson. He's been traveling full-time throughout North America for 3.5 years, and he's stopped here for a conversation with us. We're grateful for that. The new book is out. It's called Field Notes on Avoidance, and there are photographs and poems together here. We'll talk about the book, dive into the book, following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Nathan Larson. He's a poet, photographer, and wanderer, I guess you could say, lately. The last 3.5 years has been traveling full-time through North America, photographing and writing from some of the continent's most remote landscapes. Arctic Ocean, edge of Labrador, Key West, Alaska, Newfoundland. And he says photography has been his primary creative practice for decades, but his new book, Field Notes on Avoidance, is the first project where photographs and poems were created together in a single body of work. Beautiful, beautiful book. Lovingly crafted, the book itself.
Yeah, I wanted it to feel great in your hand. You know, the papers were selected. I worked with a wonderful designer, Anna Perez, to really collaborate on the design of the book. The whole impetus of the book was field journals. So I would kind of collect ephemera and press flowers and write in field journals. And so the naked spine on the book and the exposed stitching kind of harkens back to all the field journals I was writing in. So yeah, I definitely wanted it to feel like an art object in your hand.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly beautiful. So field notes on avoidance. What are you avoiding?
Well, I think there's themes in the book around watching avoidance in nature and watching us avoid things, avoid dealing with our impact on nature, watching people avoiding each other. You know, a lot of this is not only in travel, not only my time in nature, but also my time watching people. My background is in anthropology, and it's a fascination of mine just to kind of collect stories and see how we interact with each other as well. So it's a theme that I think kind of, you know, one of the poems was named that in the book, and it became the name of the collection because I think there is a theme in there of some of that avoidance and endings and edges and how you navigate those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, when you're talking about your fascinating biography, we avoided your school years, University of Chicago.
Yeah, went to University of Chicago, studied cultural anthropology, did a lot of writing while I was there, wrote for the student newspaper as well as creative essays, still doing photography as well. But yeah, it was an incredible place to go to school and study, and anthropology was really and continues to be a huge part of how I look at you know, behavior change and how we interact with each other. I think it was a wonderful education. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned edges, and mm-hmm. certainly in the, you know, the opening description of the book, remote landscape, Arctic Ocean, right? Edge of Labrador, Key West, the end of,
yes,
you know, the end of the world, Alaska, Newfoundland. Are you, I guess you're drawn to these places?
Yeah, I basically have driven the van to the farthest north, south, east, and west points you can drive in North America. And I think it was a little bit of a, when I first started the adventure, I flipped a coin every intersection that I got to. I had no plan. So I literally had a quarter, and when I'd come to an intersection, I'd flip it. And that took me kind of generally to kick off the first few months of this adventure. But then I did start to kind of decide I'm going to go as far as I can go in every cardinal direction. So part of that was then seeing all along the way, like, what it took to get to those edges and the stories it took to get to those edges, and then staying at those edges for a little while and really observing them. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it became kind of a framework for the trip for sure.
You've also said that you love detours.
Yes, that's part of that coin flipping mm-hmm. or kind of forcing detours, back roads. I think every single time I've gotten off the suggested path, I've found something spectacular. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is maybe, I mean, that probably literally and also just metaphorically, that, you know, taking the time to go that different direction or to spend time getting lost on purpose has always led to really wonderful discoveries mm-hmm. for me.
So it takes us back to a theme of there's usefulness to technology.
Yes.
But maybe the technology leads us astray sometimes. I'm thinking about Google Maps, right?
yeah.
And I've become addicted.
Yeah.
I type it in and the voice
yep.
guides me, right? But
yep.
I feel like I've lost something as well.
Yeah. The only trick I use there is you can click, I don't remember if it's Google Maps or which one you use, but avoid highways. Or there's a few different choices now.
You can use it.
Yeah, okay, you can yeah. use it to mm-hmm. your advantage to at least say, basically, take me the long way.
Yeah.
But another trick I've had is just to stay off the highways, you know, because I don't really have a time. I'm not time bound by a lot of this. But yeah, that's definitely, I notice when I do use mapping, just to your point, when I do use mapping, I tend to I put blinders on, biological blinders on, and I just get on the road and I listen to the machine tell me where to turn. And so, yeah, I try to avoid that.
Yeah. One description of your book, I'll just read this. Larson's work traces how memory, observation, and wild spaces shape our inner lives.
Yes. You know, I think it's impossible to not be influenced by what we observe in nature and the impact the wild can have on us. And I think, you know, one of those themes from Round River Conservation in that time in the Blue Range Primitive Area was that was really formative for me in realizing that. But yeah, this to me is, if you stop and observe and look at the interconnectedness of things, I don't think it can help but change you internally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's have you read a couple of poems initially here.
Okay, Tom, so, if you insist.
Okay. First one I've asked you to read is Grow Strange.
Sure. Grow Strange. I learned fearlessness from seeds, scattering on impossible winds, not asking permission to dream of becoming forest. Seeds do not calculate distance, nor worry where they will land. Trust the gale, fly as far as God's breath will carry. The oak born in my field grows crooked, unbothered by bent branches, always reaching for dawn. I am at peace with not knowing where I'll settle, what I'll lose. Maps have never mattered much to those who learn to turn. I will grow strange, leaning, wandering for radiance. I cast myself to the tempest.
Mm-hmm. Grow strange. I will grow strange. What do you mean there?
I think it just means to allow yourself to be whatever you want to be, no matter what other people's definition is. You know, how do you how do you reach your full potential of you? And sometimes I think we feel a lot of pressure to conform and be something that we're defined to be or told to be or society thinks we should be. And this is a little bit about casting yourself to the wind and going where you naturally need to go.
Yeah. Let me have you read another one. This is just a few pages over. Rivers Love by Moving.
Okay. Rivers love by moving. You are not half. You are not missing. You are unabridged by design, built from the same carbon that hums in a cardinal's wing. I love endings, cherry blossoms when they fall. I adore rocks that crumble, trees that bend and break. Impermanence makes each touch love electric. The way rivers love by moving, caressing every shore before surrendering to the sea, evaporating to sky, beginning again.
In one sense, here you did the edges that we've talked about, the end of the continent, right? But also, I guess that your line here, impermanence makes each touch love electric. Kind of a contrast there.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is for me to hear how other people interpret these.
So,
I certainly have an interesting point of view on them. But as I've watched people read these and pick up on lines in them, it is so fascinating to see what resonates with people. And I think for me, you know, I wrote this in Glacier National Park. And specifically watching a river that had carved out the rock there. And so it was also kind of, I think about being in that moment writing this. But yeah, it's got a lot packed in there.
there's a very brief poem, Wyoming Prayer.
Okay.
It's page 17.
I'm glad you know the page number, so I don't have
yeah.
to... There we go. Okay, page 17. Yeah, I lived in Wyoming for a number of years as a kid. Wyoming is a big part of my heart. So here's a poem. Wyoming Prayer. Sagebrush argues with wind about who was here first, who will remain after. Is God the wind by another name, the way it stands up straight and cuts through everything without apology or permission?
Maybe talk a little bit about this photograph, striking photograph that accompanies Wyoming Prayer. And the poems and the photographs don't necessarily pair with each other, but this really struck me.
Yeah, that's right. The poems aren't necessarily kind of the moment when the photographs and the poems don't necessarily come from the same place. Sometimes they're juxtapositions. This to me was about just the grandeur and the inevitability and the power of nature, and this photo really speaks to me for that theme as well. That is actually Mount Ascutney, that mountain in that photo, for people who end up with the book on page 16. Do a little bit of a visual description of the light coming down on the mountain, and just that, to me, that grandeur was what was captured in this photo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that resonates with me, Wyoming, that high country. I'm familiar most with the those high plains.
Yes.
7,000 feet up, and it's flat, but it's high, and you feel very exposed.
Yeah, and I think as a kid, I found, you know, wide open spaces of Wyoming led to wide open imagination and wide open mind to mm-hmm. me. I had a mom who was really encouraging us to explore and be creative, and then I had a landscape that allowed for that as well. So, yeah, you feel very exposed, but also I think it's very awe-inspiring at the same time.
Here's another quote describing your book. I'll ask you to respond to this. At his heart, Field notes on avoidance ask what it means to belong, to land, to memory, to one another.
Yeah, I think part of the contemplation I've been doing in nature and on this trip is relationships and, you know, what we carry with us from our relationships with other people. And how to be intentional in the relationships that we want to build with people. So, yeah, I mean, there's deeply personal things in the book, and there's also observational things in the book. There's total creative writing in the book, but that's a theme for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you set out to do on this trip, and do you think you've accomplished it?
I don't think I'm there yet. I kind of have always said that I'll know when I'm done. I mean, someone told me yesterday that they think of me as like that running scene in Forrest Gump where he finally just stops running. So I don't know if I'm doing that, and I'll know when I know. But I think what I set out to do is really to take time, to really stop, to really get back into the natural landscapes and to see landscapes that I've always wanted to see. I mean, I've driven to Homer, Alaska and talked my way onto a small plane and flown to those remote national parks that you can only get to by plane and sat with the coastal brown bears and just things that I've always wanted to do and experience that I didn't want to waste another moment waiting to do. So I think some of it I have accomplished, but I don't feel done yet.
Yeah. You talked yourself onto a plane.
Yeah. Didn't so, have a plan? Well, there was, there was no room and there was, everything was booked out. So I started hanging out at this bar with where all the pilots hang out after work and just got to know them over a couple days. And I was camped there for a week and got to know one pilot in particular. And we became kind of chummy over the course of the week. And he found a seat for me on one of the planes.
Yeah.
And
so,
You got to do what you got to do, Tom.
That's right. You have to. So a lot of nature, right? But tell me about another couple of people that you've
met. Yeah, well, I mean, I've observed, I've met some incredible people. One thing I'll say about this is that I have not been anywhere where I haven't met wonderful people and had incredible experiences with the people I've met. There hasn't been a place that I've visited where I have felt unwelcome or where people haven't been incredibly, you know, accommodating and helpful. So, I mean, whether it's these Alaskan bush pilots that I you know became friends with in Homer, or down in Alabama, I stayed on the coast for quite a while and got to meet a couple who ran a general store down there and became friends with them, and they would let me go in and get pizza in their shop every night for free. And yeah, just wonderful experiences. When you open yourself up and take the time to just allow that to happen, it's probably back to that theme you brought up of not rushing. You know, I think we rush past each other quite a bit too. So what happens if I stop to talk to somebody for 5 minutes? It's a totally different experience, you know?
Let's take another break. We're talking with Nathan Larson. His new book is out now. It's called Field Notes on Avoidance, a beautiful book. And Nathan, you were telling me that for listeners of Access Utah, you get a deal.
Yes, if you go to nathanlarson.com, there is a Access Utah promo code you can use for a discount on the book. So there's a banner on top of the website. Just go to nathanlarson.com and use the code Access Utah for a discount.
All right. Very good. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have with us in studio Nathan Larson. He's a photographer and a poet, traveler. The past 3.5 years, he's been traveling full-time through North America, photographing and writing from some of the continent's most remote landscapes. His new book is out and available now. It's called Field Notes on Avoidance, and you can find that at wherever you get your books, and also at nathanlarson.com, where if you look for that Access Utah promo code, you can get a discount on the book. So Nathan Larson, maybe have you choose a poem or two.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were just kind of talking about people, and one of the things I've done is collect stories as I move through this trip. And this particular story was from a schoolhouse, an abandoned schoolhouse, a one-room schoolhouse in Kansas, and just kind of learning about the people who had built it and gone there and talking to some of the historians, I wrote this poem. Where heaven meets tall grass. The last chalk mark wiped clean, and the boys are wild horses racing through the doorframe of possibilities. I step slowly, taking deep breaths. The whistle from Miss Pierce's kettle rings in my ears, reminding me of the train I've never seen, but Billy swears cuts the earth in half. My grandmother's calico stitches hold my shoulders like her hands, my sunbonnet casting shade across thoughts too wild to speak aloud. I count cattle dots on distant hills, my eyes collecting them like pennies, while my feet find familiar stones on the path to Fox Creek. The meadowlarks sing hymns I never hear on Sundays, their brash voices igniting the late afternoon air. I slide my feet from leather prisons, my skin remembering its first language, toes spreading wide as I ease them into shimmering cool waters. I whisper to the horizon and wonder, could heaven be any more beautiful than this? Today makes my small heart almost too full to carry home.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Maybe another one?
Sure. And then maybe on the flip side, this is a bit of, you know, that theme of avoidance or edges, but in relationships. This is called Small Hours. We do not speak of the rift between ridge and rain, but I feel it. Dust settling in my throat. Your breath fogs the window. My mind stays with the evergreens. We sit side by side in observant isolation. Saguaros bloom only at night. Moths with powdered wings, blossoms folding open. I do not need your rainwater to keep growing. If you are still here when the coyote's quiet, we will call it trying.
Yeah. Wonderful. Maybe one last one. Could you read page 70, page 75?
Sure.
Last of the Analogs.
Oh, for sure.
We're on the radio here, so this
Yeah, and there's a wonderful image of mixtapes used to be a big part of my life. So my friends and I would make mixtapes for each other and create covers. And so there's a photo of a mixtape that goes along with this one.
And it says label is Valentine's Blues.
Yes.
Valentine's Day Blues.
From my girlfriend at the time. And she had made a mix for me for Valentine's Day.
Could you pull your microphone?
Just you got
there it. There you go.
How's that?
Yeah.
All right. Last of the Analogs. I remember the sound of disconnection, the static between stations, the act of hanging up a phone. I lived in the age of mixtape urgency, delicately threading shimmering ribbon, wielding a pencil to wind cassettes past their wrinkled scars, a surgeon hovering over two plastic buttons, waiting for the precise moment, the sacred ritual of play and record. I measured time by the length of side A, by counting the sunsets before my letters found hands, by the precious minutes each quarter coin granted, by the languid timer on dark room walls. What will my son's body remember when he reaches the meridian of his life?
Mm-hmm. So your long hours on the road, do you play mixtapes, the equivalent?
I do, yeah. I have tons of playlists I've made. I have playlists that friends have sent me. Music is definitely a big part of being on the road for me. And I think this was a bit of also, exploring that theme of slowing down. I guess it's a little bit to always like yearn for yesteryear, but I'm not really trying to do that in this poem as much as I'm trying to remember. There is a different way, an intentional pace, and we have a choice. And this poem was me kind of exploring that theme.
Yeah. We just have a couple minutes left. So 3.5 years now
on
the road.
It's too quick, Tom. It's too quick.
You say you'll know when you're done. I get what will that feeling be? You'll just be like Forrest Gump and you'll like stop running?
I think so. You know, I'm writing another book right now that will come out this fall, and it's definitely been inspired by kind of the second part of this trip. So I think, you know, it's inspiring my writing. It's inspiring my photography. So right now, I think it's creative energy that I need. And yeah, I'll know when it's time to maybe at least stop for a few months at a time and take a different way of exploring creatively.
Can you tell us anything about the new book?
Yeah, it's a bit more current event driven, and it's called Unspun. It'll be out this fall. And it's a shorter book, and definitely driven by more of the human stories that I've picked up over the last year, I would say, and the impact that, you know, we've had on each other as communities. So, yeah, I'm excited to have it come out this fall.
We've been talking with Nathan Larson. His latest book is called Field Notes on Avoidance, a beautiful book, poems and photographs. And you can go to anywhere to buy it, but we're suggesting you go to NathanLarson.com where you can find a promo code.
Yeah, promo code. Use AccessUtah at NathanLarson.com. You can see a lot of my photographs at NathanLarson.com as well as see the book there and use the promo code if you're interested.
Yeah. So where are you off to next after Logan?
I'm going to head down through southern Utah. There's, as you probably your listeners are well aware, some large wildfires. And I just came up through the Babylon fire a couple days ago. So I'm headed back down that direction. Took some photos of that, which are up on my Instagram page at Nathan Larson Photo. And then I'm going to go down through Flagstaff and down into New Mexico. So that's my next general direction.
All right. Well, safe travels and
hey,
we'll look forward to your future work.
Thank you so much. And it's such a pleasure to meet you. And your interviews over the years have been such an inspiration for me. So thanks for taking time with me today.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Well, thank you for coming in, Nathan Larson. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.